Excellent. The last case on the court's calendar this morning is State of Minnesota versus Michael Letourneau. And we're ready for arguments from Council of Record. Mr. Nyvold, would you present your argument to the court, please?
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. I'm Mark Nyvold, representing Mr. Letourneau. This case presents a situation of the district court essentially not doing anything correct according to the statute, the Detainer Act statute, for bringing the defendant to trial. The time in which to start the trial was never correctly computed. And then the court and the case was passed from one judge to another until Judge Starr holds a pretrial conference in mid-August and does not state the correct date for the trial date, or that by which the trial had to start, which was September 8th, based on a March 8th filing of the detainer request, or request for action on the detainer. So instead of Judge Starr, instead of relying on that September 8th date, basically speculates that the defense is unprepared, wouldn't be ready in the time frame the court envisions, which extends to October, which is not correct. So the court has the wrong time frame, no request or explanation for the defense as to why they cannot be ready by the correct date, again, which was never determined by the court. And the case starts well beyond the time in which it, by statute, should have started. So that's the UMDDA violation. They're really, and the court in the August 16th pretrial is simply speculating that the defense needs more time. There was no basis for doing that. So it's pretty apparent that the state or court did not meet its obligation, because it's the court that has to do this. It's not the state bringing it to trial on time. The defense, the obligation rests squarely with the court, and it got key facts wrong and speculated as to other facts that resulted in a time frame that wasn't correct in any event. So,
Mr. Nyvold, I'm hoping that you can help me understand the record. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. So in your brief, you say that your client would have been out of custody but for the filing of these new charges. And I couldn't find support for that in the record. And I'm wondering if you can point me to where I can find that support.
Well, I'm not really recalling focusing on that. I'm not sure what difference that made. They still had a set amount of, it doesn't affect the time in which the court had to bring the case to trial, whether he was.
My understanding is that your client was in custody until the following February from the October trial date.
Yes, I think that's what they asserted, is that he would have still been in custody. But I don't know how that basically takes away his rights to have his trial start within a certain amount of time, or within the set time set by the statute.
And what was he in custody for? New charges?
Well, he had been serving a sentence. He was in prison when he filed his request under the Detainer Act for this new case. So he was still under custody supervision by the state, or in the prison system.
Well, that's the point of UMDA, right? It's my understanding that the reason we have the Uniform Mandatory Disposition of Detainers Act is to remove holds so that people can engage in programming while they're in prison. So I think remaining in custody is the expectation. So I'm not understanding perhaps the question.
I'm I'm not seeing any connection between the fact that he was still in DOC custody, and that means he didn't have that doesn't mean he didn't have a right to have his trial start within the 6 months. Okay. I don't think that's relevant at all. So
my understanding of UMDA, as Judge Larkin called it, was that you have to get to trial within 6 months of making the request, but the 6 months can be extended for good cause. Do you agree with that?
Yes, but Letourneau never asked for that, and there was never any good cause shown. I mean, when Judge Starr decided to, Judge Starr had no idea when the correct required start date was, which was September 8th. She speculated
that your client was facing significant criminal sexual conduct charges and that he had received a new attorney after the first one, either retired. I wasn't sure exactly what happened to his first attorney. The record says retired or left the office, but in any event, he had a new attorney midway through summer.
Yes, that was Mr. Reamer, and he was at the August 16th pretrial conference. He never said he couldn't be prepared. He never said anything.
But when Judge Starr said, certainly you want time to be able to prepare for these serious charges, he didn't say, oh, no, I'm ready to go.
Nobody didn't ask for more time. This is just Judge Starr speculating that he needs more time. Normally, the way it works is if the attorney needs more time, he or she asks for it. That's very clear.
Okay. How was your client prejudiced? Because in looking at some of the case law regarding claims that case should have been dismissed for failure to bring it to trial within 6 months, the Supreme Court tends to look at, was there prejudice? How long was the delay and was there prejudice? How was your client prejudiced by holding this trial a month or two past the 6 month deadline?
Well, I don't believe prejudice is part of the analysis. They have to have a set amount of time to in which to bring them to trial. And the state never asked for a showing of prejudice.
Prejudice it seems to be considered by the appellate courts. Go ahead. I'll find the case and I'll bring it to the attention of everyone.
The 6 months is essentially a fixed time within which to bring the case to trial.
And Mr. Nabold, it isn't essentially even if you were to look at it from a plain error analysis, the substantial rights effectively presumes prejudice as well, aren't we? We're in the same land, whether we use the Barker factors in a speedy trial analysis or plain error analysis, there has to be that level. And here, essentially, he's being held, and that's why that becomes relevant, doesn't it? And the fact that it's a significant new of charges, and it was only approximately a month later than the deadline.
Well, as it was alluded to earlier, he wanted to pursue programming, and he wasn't able to do that because of the detainer. So,
where is that in the record?
Yeah.
Well, I think it was brought up at one of the hearings. I know there was a reference to it in the record, but the case law puts the focus on, the court having the obligation to bring the case to trial. It's not up to the court to imagine, as Judge Starr did, that defense counsel can't be ready when she never even asked him if that was the case and got the dates wrong for when the trial had to start. I think Judge Starr, if had she known the correct date, would have obviously set a date earlier, by on or before September 8th. That didn't happen. So, you know, this is a fixed time frame in which the case has to be brought to trial. And, you know, they didn't do that. I mean, that's... unless the court has any questions, that's all I have at this point.
All right. We'll hear from the state. Would you introduce yourself for the record?
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Thomas Raggetts. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney, and I represent respondent, state of Minnesota, in this matter. I don't have much to say this morning. My brief addresses all the appellant's arguments. He didn't file a reply brief and hasn't made any new arguments today or cited any new cases. And he simply can't meet his burden of establishing plain error, which he establishes is the test here, for at least three reasons. First of all, appellant repeatedly says, well, Judge Starr just speculated about whether the defense couldn't be ready on time, the new defense counsel. But the problem is, there was never any objection below to this. So we have no record of whether Judge Starr was basing that comment on discussions in chambers, on an email from defense counsel. Defense counsel could have very easily said, oh no, Your Honor, I can certainly be ready on time. Let's keep this moving. Defense counsel had numerous opportunities to do so. Defense counsel never did that. And that's why, as appellant concedes, we're under plain error review here, because appellant below never said, wait, there was no good cause here. I was all ready to go. We just don't know from this record what the situation was. We don't know whether, in fact, new defense counsel could have started the trial within the 6 months. And again, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, and again, it would have been very easy on numerous opportunities before Judge Starr or Judge Yang for defense counsel to say, I'm all ready to go, or I was all ready to go. That was just unfounded speculation, as appellant now says, for the first time on appeal. So that's the first part of how appellant can't meet his burden under the plain error test. Also, it's important here that there's no claim of prejudice to the defense. There is no allegation on the record that I'm aware of that he was denied programming he could have otherwise gotten. Maybe Mr. Nival can point us something to that on rebuttal, but I'm not aware of anything like that. The Hamilton case on page 13 of my brief does talk about prejudice. So prejudice is not irrelevant here. Prejudice always applies under the plain error test. But even if we weren't under the plain error test, under Hamilton, Hamilton talks about a delay of a month being minimal. That's all we have here is a delay of a month. So it's minimal. Again, there's no allegation here that, well, if my trial started a month earlier, I could have called this witness or I would have done something different. So there's no allegation of prejudice to the defense. And again, there isn't even any allegation that he was prejudiced in terms of his time in the DOC, which, as Judge Riley correctly pointed out, was noted not to expire until February of the following year. So it's not like he would have been out enjoying his freedom, but for this 1 month delay.
But does that matter if the whole purpose of UMDA is to make people eligible to participate in programming? So I'm having a hard time understanding how the fact that he was going to be in custody anyway matters, because I thought the point of the statute was we don't want people to have unresolved charges while they're in prison if those charges result in a detainer, which prevents them from participating in programming. Is that not why we have UMDA?
That's true, Your Honor, but the Supreme Court has not said that because that is the purpose, prejudice is irrelevant. Supreme Court has looked
I agree with you. And I said, because you're right. Hamilton was the case I was thinking of. And in Hamilton, the Supreme Court said, you know, it was only a month delay and, quote unquote, there was no indication or even a claim that the defendant was prejudiced by the delay, indicating that the Supreme Court thinks you look at whether there was prejudice in deciding whether an UMDA requirement or UMDA violation warrants relief.
Yes, that's my point, Your Honor. And I guess as to the programming, my point is simply that it would have been easy for appellant to make some allegation below of denied programming, but we don't even have that. So again, we just don't have a good enough record here to reach any of the conclusions that appellant asks us to reach, which doesn't mean that appellant is out of luck, for lack of a better term. Appellant can always file a claim of ineffective assistance of trial counsel and claim the trial counsel should have said, yes, I was ready to go. And then we'd know whether that was true or not. It might not be true.
Well, he did file a self-represented supplemental brief alleging that trial counsel was ineffective. And I saw that that came in about a month after you filed your brief.
Right. And I filed a letter response to that. But I guess my point is there should have been a post-conviction claim of that so we could develop the record. The point here is we just don't know if Mr. Reamer was ready to go or not. Appellant's asking us to speculate that Judge Starr was wrong about that. But if Judge Starr was wrong, why wouldn't he have spoken up and said, nope, I'm all ready to go. I've only had 2 months, but still, it's fine. I'm new to this case. In fact, Reamer said at that hearing, this is the first time I've heard about these aggravating factors. So that certainly seems to suggest that he wasn't all ready to go.
So I have a legal question for you. When I read some of the UMDA cases, they also do a Barker analysis. Do you think that's necessary in this case?
I don't under Hamilton. I don't because there is no speedy trial issue here. I think lots of times a speedy trial issue and an UMDA issue will sort of be together in a brief. They're raising both, maybe as alternative claims or supplemental claims. And appellant has conceded in his brief that he's not making a speedy trial claim here. So I think under Hamilton, you have to look at prejudice. I think the main issue here is simply whether Judge Starr abused her judicial discretion and did so plainly, because we're under plain error analysis, in finding good cause. And I mentioned that were at least three reasons that appellant can't meet his burden under the plain error test. And the first is, again, under these facts, it would have been easy for defense counsel to say, nope, I'm ready to go. He never did that. So we can't even show that there was error here.
Mr. Raggetts, you really strongly focus on that. Would you at least acknowledge it's a bit, from my experience, I might know an attorney and know whether they're ever prepared or not prepared and judge it with the charges. But it sure makes it hard for our appellate review. It's unique, I assume, in your experience, it would be in mind that the judge sua sponte would say the attorney's not ready. And so, because you're kind of shifting the analysis to, well, attorney should have jumped up and said, I'm ready. But the whole discussion was about the timing and it was going to be delayed, the impression I got anyway. So I assume you concede at least that's a unique scenario where we discredit the defendant for counsel's failure to jump up and respond to the judge.
I think that goes to my my problem here with the lack of record, because we don't know if this was sua sponte. It could have been following in chambers discussion. It could have been following an email from Reamer saying, I need more time. We just don't know here because appellant never raised this issue below. Appellant never, even later in front of Judge Yang, said there was not good cause here because my attorney was ready to go. So that's where we need a better record. And that's where appellant can and perhaps should file a post-conviction claim of ineffective assistance. So Reamer can explain his state of readiness and we can know a little more about why Judge Starr did this. It seems very unlikely that Judge Starr would have just assumed out of the blue the defense wasn't ready without any clues or hints or anything from defense counsel. But we just don't know here. We don't have a good enough record. And that ultimately is appellant's problem on appeal because it's plain error review. He has the burden of establishing the record this court would need to do something as extreme as he's asking for in this case, which is essentially letting appellant walk free, despite the fact that he was convicted beyond a reasonable doubt of two rapes of a 13-year-old. We're not talking about retrial here. We're talking about just saying these charges have to be dismissed completely. And under the plain error review, he can't meet his burden under the facts I've just talked about, under the lack of prejudice I've already talked about. And his third major problem is under that fourth prong of the plain error test. And I'd refer this court again to the Polzinski case discussed in my brief. Polzinski says you have to look beyond the facts of the case, and you can only win on plain error if the case is such that if it isn't reversed, it's going to cause the public to generally question the integrity of our entire judicial system. Well, how can that be the case here? That not letting someone get away with these rapes that have been proven beyond reasonable doubt is going to cause the public to doubt our legal system. seems the reverse, actually, especially here, where it would have been so easy for defense counsel to say, Judge, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I am all ready to go. Let's get this done within the 6 months. The state was ready to go. Defense counsel could have very easily done that, but didn't. And that's why we're under plain error review here. And appellant can't meet any parts of the four-part plain error test. There's been some talk this morning about the dates and whether Judge Starr was confused about the dates. But the important point here is there's no dispute that Judge Starr found good cause within the 6 months. If it had been outside of the 6 months, that'd be a very different story. And there's also no argument here that, yes, there was good cause, but there was only good cause for 3 weeks, not four. Then maybe the dates would be relevant. But appellant's argument is simply that there was no good cause at all. So whether this was 37 days late or 33 days late, I really can't see how that could possibly be relevant here. And whether the trial should have started on October 11th or the 12th, I also don't see how that could be relevant here. I mean, the case law says that the motion on the 11th told the timing. But appellant's argument is, well, it doesn't matter because we're already beyond the 6 months and there was no good cause. So ultimately, the only issue here is, did Judge Starr abuse her discretion plainly in finding good cause during that 6 month period? And she didn't under these facts. Appellant can claim ineffective assistance of trial counsel on post-conviction for defense counsel not speaking up and getting this done within the 6 months. But under this record, he just cannot prevail. It doesn't matter who initially had the burden here of establishing good cause because Judge Starr made a finding. So now it's appellant's burden on appeal to show that that finding is wrong, that it's an abuse of judicial discretion. That's the standard set out on pages 7 and 8 of my brief, and that there was plain error here. So I think that covers all of the things I wanted to say today. I'm going to take a quick look at my notes. And I'm happy to answer any other questions the court might have. But otherwise, the case law talks about the need for flexibility. The case law talks about judicial discretion. The case law talks about prejudice. Under all the case law cited in my brief, appellant cannot meet his heavy burden of establishing plain error that requires him to walk free on these two first-degree criminal sexual conduct convictions. And I'll simply ask this court to affirm.
May I have a response?
Of course, Mr. Neivold.
Much of the speculation discussed here has to do with this idea that there were discussions between Judge Starr and defense counsel and the prosecutor off the record. That's speculation. Normally, if something like that had happened, the judge would say, well, as we've discussed in chambers, Mr. Greemer, you said you cannot be ready within a certain amount of time. That's the speculation. And secondly, once the court got the date wrong, everything else, nothing that followed from that can be supported. If the judge knew that she was dealing with a September 8th deadline to get the case started, that would be one thing. But she didn't. She's operating under a complete ignorance, apparently, of when this case had to start. And that matters. So you can't say the judge acted within her discretion and was factually supported when she doesn't even know the basic key fact in this whole issue, which is when does this case have to get to trial? Everything after that, or because of that, everything that follows is in question. So this idea that Mr. Letourneau has to pursue a post-conviction petition. No, thank you for your help, but no, that's not really the state's decision to make. There was a valid issue under the statute as to the trial not starting within the time required, and that by itself makes the district court's analysis faulty. You can't rely on what Judge Starr said.
Mr. Neivold, now that I've found the Hamilton case, I'll ask you again. You know, the Supreme Court said in Hamilton, in assessing whether or not there was good cause for continuance beyond the 6 months, that appellant in that case made no claim of prejudice, and there was no obvious prejudice. So that tells us the Supreme Court looks at a good faith, abuse of discretion determination, and factors in prejudice, having nothing to do with the Barker factors. And you seem to be arguing that, well, if it's not at 6 months, end of story, the case gets dismissed. Well, I'll give you an opportunity, since the Supreme Court has says it looks at prejudice. What was the prejudice to your client of having this trial delayed 1 or 2 months?
Well, again, I know it's in the record because I read it, and exactly what the source was, I can't pinpoint at this moment. But Mr. Letourneau did talk about the fact that if this detainer didn't exist, he would have been eligible or at least sought programming. So I would like to have the option to submit a short letter citing where that is in the record. I may be wrong, and if I'm wrong, I'll say I couldn't find it. But that's my request.
Well, and do we know that it's prejudice in terms of programming, or is it prejudice in terms of ability to go forward at trial, but probably more likely regarding programming?
Well, obviously he wanted to get programmed. Yes. So if this case could have been resolved sooner, that may have impacted his ability to get programmed.
Yeah.
But
we have the record, and we have the ability to look through the record, and the Hamilton case is an old case. So it's not that something that anybody should be surprised by in terms of how the Supreme Court analyzes these things. So I don't think it's necessary to have any additional briefing on the issue from either party.
Thank you.
Thank you. It looks like that, if there are no other questions, that concludes the hearing, and you will have our decision within the time required by statute. Thank you for your arguments in the briefing. That concludes the court's morning calendar.
Thank you.
Thank you.